Well, thank you all for being here, and can I get a round of applause for Usenix and SREcon for putting on this great conference? Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk a little bit about what we've been doing at Dropbox. But first, let me introduce myself. My name is Zach Kriya. Prior to joining Dropbox, I worked at a software company where I did a little bit of everything. I started off as a database administrator, ended up doing operations management, and finally spent a couple of years creating and managing an SRE team for them. I joined Dropbox about 15 months ago as a technical program manager. I specifically joined to be a member of the reliability team. The reliability team is actually more of a virtual team than anything else. It's made up of directors and senior directors, plus myself and one other TPM. And we're really meant to be able to try and improve reliability across all of Dropbox. So we're trying to build out programs that can be applied globally. What am I going to talk about today? First, a bit of background about Dropbox and sort of the old days. I'm then going to spend most of my time talking about the changes that we've been making over the last couple of years in order to improve reliability. And then I want to talk just a little bit about where we're going and how maybe you can get started or apply some of what we've been doing to your company. But first, why does reliability matter to Dropbox? So for those of you who may not be familiar, Dropbox is primarily known as a storage company, which allows users to provide data to us, which we then give them access to anywhere that there's internet. And inherent in that business model is the idea that users rely on us to store their important data and make it available to them. And that responsibility is so important to us that we've codified it into one of our core company values, which is to be worthy of trust. You know, and for every Dropboxer, this matters, and it applies to them. So no matter what your role, each person should be thinking about and demonstrating that they're worthy of trust in the work that they do. But specifically for those of us inside of infrastructure, who are responsible for storing and serving over 500 petabytes of data that we house on our own on our own infrastructure, we strive to be worthy of trust by ensuring that reliability is a first-class citizen at all times. So, hold on, what's reliability? I assume it's pretty obvious to most of you and likely even in your job title, but I want to make sure to define terms. So at Dropbox specifically, we think about reliability as having three main components. For us, the first and most important is durability, which is essentially the idea that data should not be lost or corrupted. Secondly, we think about it as availability, which is, well, it just works. You go to the website and it's up, your desktop client works as expected. And then finally, we also think about performance, and that just means that your data is arriving in a timely manner. Okay, enough of the intro stuff. Let's get started. So, I promised a beginning story. Once upon a time, there was a man named Drew, and he was going on a bus trip between Boston and New York. And he was planning on working on a project during the trip. Once the bus took off, he realized that he had forgotten his thumb drive, which had all the files that he needed to work on the project. And out of the source of that frustration and experience, he said, "We have the internet. Why do I need a thumb drive?" He decided to make a company out of it. So he and our co-founder, Arash, moved to San Francisco and started working on that product. And the first, you know, couple of years or whatever, as with most companies, that time was mostly spent building a product that people wanted to use and then finding those users who were excited about it. Well, we found people that were excited about it. It didn't take us very long for a whole bunch of people to want to use it in very short order. And in fact, we went from 1 million to 4 million to 40 to 400 million in a really short period of time. So what about those infrastructure people, right? You had a couple of them. Well, for them, it was a little bit of that, you know, fighting chaos. Well, and what it meant, though, is that that small team, for each of those engineers, they were responsible both for building critical services and systems that didn't exist before. Remember, this is a brand new product. But they were also, at the same time, responsible for responding to pages and resolving site outages. So there wasn't any silos. There wasn't, you were the one person that took all the pages. Everybody had context. Everybody responded as needed. But to give you a little idea of how it looked and felt back then, there used to be a daily, what was called doomsday meeting, or sorry, weekly doomsday meeting, where the team had to meet and figure out whether or not they had enough runway between when the hard drives would arrive and they could rack and stack them before the databases were going to run out of space. So there was like a lot of churn and trying to keep things up. But really, we were successful. We're here, right? And so looking back on it, if you ask the question why, we really think that it was that culture of collaboration that was our key to success. It was the fact that everybody pulled together and was responsible for the site collectively that really took us through that patch of hypergrowth. So then what changed? You could say, well, that's was successful. Like, I'd be up here and just say, make sure you have a bunch of engineers. They know everything about everything. You're good to go. All done. Well, unsurprisingly, we outgrew that particular model. And in fact, we hit an inflection point, or you might call it an existential crisis, where we realized that things weren't working as well as before, and we needed to start making some changes. Specifically, we had started outgrowing the old model around our size. Like, our infrastructure footprint had grown significantly. And not only that, we had a much bigger team. So instead of it being 12 or 40 people that were inside of infrastructure, we now had 100 or even more that were working every day to build new services that we needed, clearly. But all of that was adding complexity to our environment. And so what that meant is the things that were working before weren't working as well. And specifically, we had two areas that we wanted to try and improve. The first was our incident response. We were finding that back when it was a much smaller team, they were really well-oiled. A page would come in or a site would have an event, everybody would swarm, the issue would be resolved fairly quickly, and then we would move on. But as things grew, we just weren't quite as smooth as we needed to be. So we knew we needed to look at incident response. And then the second issue was we had an inconsistency of reliability, if you will. Like, there were some teams that were great at it and some teams that just weren't quite as good. So we wanted to be able to tackle both of them, and we were thinking about how we could do that. So the first thing we realized is, well, we couldn't just throw more people at it. Like, it's the same thing of like expecting every single person to be able to solve problems isn't really going to do it. So instead, what we decided is that we were going to try and introduce process as a proxy for some of the experience that we had had before. But before we started trying to improve anything, we wanted to make sure that we had sort of a central set of problems or questions that we were trying to answer. The first was, we wanted to make sure that we could understand which services were impacting our users. Like, when your systems are smaller, it's a lot easier to understand and answer that question. But as complexity starts creeping in, it becomes really hard to predict, and in fact, you might not even be able to. So whatever we designed, we wanted to be able to answer that particular question. We also wanted to know why things were breaking. If you look at any given incident, clearly you could say, all right, well, this was at fault. But again, we're trying to answer this problem at scale. Are there any global trends that we're seeing that we can address? We also wanted to know if we'd fixed it. So you want to make sure as a company that globally, when we see problems, we're getting better and that they're no longer at risk. And again, there's no way to do that collectively without starting to try and solve that problem. And finally, and maybe even most importantly, we wanted to make sure that we could be faster next time. Again, we're always trying to be worthy of trust, which for us means that we want to be as responsive as possible to issues and minimize any downtime that might happen. So what did we decide to do? Well, we took a two-pronged approach where we started first with our incident management, and we tried to build in ways to be able to then scale information that we were getting from each individual incident to be able to start addressing global issues. So, first thing we did was take a look at the SEV process. But before I start, I should define my terms. What is a SEV? I believe that Facebook uses the term site event for a sieve. For us, sieve is just a noun. It's a sieve. And what that means is it's essentially unexpected behavior that rises above a particular threshold, right? And before I move on, I should explain the pictures. We have a tool that we use for filing our sieves called DropSev, and it assigns it a name. And instead of using like numbers or anything like that, it provides a randomly generated adjective and animal, which is both memorable and a little funny when you're otherwise stressed out. So I mentioned that sieves are essentially incidences that rise above the threshold of a bug. There are definitely a few areas that will always be considered a sieve. For us, the first and foremost is going to be data loss. I hope it's unsurprising after explaining what Dropbox does. We have zero tolerance for data loss, but that also includes anything that relates to potential data loss, recoverable data loss. All of that will be a sieve. And I haven't spoken about this before, but it might be obvious that not only should we be worthy of trust by ensuring that we preserve data, but we want to make sure that we are only providing it, access to it, to the people that we're intended to. So therefore, any security risk will also be considered a sieve. Just like any other product, if your product isn't available, you've got problems, so we always want to make sure to capture availability. And finally, there is specific features that either rise in scope or because they're critical to our users that will be considered a sieve. Okay, so I use the word sieve process. What do I mean? Basically, I just mean a set of processes that cover incident management end to end. Most people, when they think about it, really think about it only from the first component, which is the time when the user is being impacted. But we actually wanted to make sure that we were as effective throughout the entire lifecycle. For incident management, we had had an incident management process in place, but it had started becoming less useful. So we did a few things to tweak it to try and make it more effective. And the reason why we did, I think, is sort of represented well in this quote, which is that, again, whenever you're having an incident, the goal is to try and be as effective as possible. You don't really want to panic or current flail. You want to be as close to a well-oiled machine as you can. So the more you can prepare, the better. But really, the first thing that we did is actually address the nature of your emergency or trying to establish a common framework that everybody understood to make sure that we were addressing incidences in the proper way. And what I mean by that is if something goes down and I think it's the most important thing in the world, but the service owner is like, eh, you know, it doesn't really matter, you're going to spend the first part of that incident trying to negotiate how quickly somebody should address it. So in order to help with that, we tried to make sure that we were very clear about what was considered a particular level of emergency. So for us, we use sublevels to describe those. I could use words, but it's easier to use an analogy. So for us, the SEV 3 could be thought of as like, you know, your microwave's on fire. It's a problem. Somebody should do something. Hopefully somebody close will put it out. What you don't want is it to get to a SEV 2 where the kitchen's kind of caught on fire, and now hopefully a few more people are starting to interact with this and they're starting to care a little bit more. By the time you get to a SEV 1, you've got a serious issue. There's multiple teams involved. At this point, hopefully nobody's going to a meeting. That's just not a good thing. And finally, we use SEV 0, which is critical service impact. We think of this as a company-level interrupt. This is severe enough that if I went up to Drew and said, I needed your help, we have a SEV 0, he would understand, stop everything, and help, because everybody should be helping with this if it happens. And then the second thing we did was, again, try to make sure that we were effective in the moment. And again, one of the reasons we were successful in incidences back in the day was because everybody was really good at responding to issues when they arose. So in order to help scale that experience, we developed a program for incident managers where we provided training and a 24/7 on call for high severity incidents so that at least there was somebody there that would help make sure that we were effective and efficient and when something was happening. Okay, so the second piece of the process that we took a look at was the postmortem. Most people understand what's in a postmortem, and we didn't change too much about the general nature of it. Instead, our problem was that we were having a really hard time understanding how to address problems globally when they were trapped in Google Docs. So we kind of moved them away from each being sort of standalone and into a ticketing system. And while we were doing that, we decided to make sure that we could characterize incidents across a couple of dimensions so that we could later look into it. The first was we really wanted to make sure we could capture the impact of the individual incident. So we tooled and made sure to capture the percentage or number of users that were impacted, as well as the time that was spent. We also wanted to understand why things failed. So we made sure to categorize them across a couple of different dimensions, including if any systems issues like isolation or cascading failure. We also wanted to understand when there were process failures, such as lack of testing or lack of training or alerting or metrics. And finally, we wanted to understand our dependencies a little bit better. So we made sure to capture not just the root cause system, but all of our downstream or affected systems that were a part of it. But I think that the real meat of the change that we made that was most meaningful was to our reliability reviews. First, let me just sing the praises of reliability reviews in the first place. It's pretty easy to just document everything into a postmortem and call it one and done. But it's really through the act of talking about it with your peers and making sure that everybody's understanding it that you can elevate that incident and begin to spread out some of the knowledge that you're learning to a greater audience. So there was a culture of reliability reviews before, but they were really ad hoc. They would only happen when somebody said, we really should talk about this. And then it ended up being a room of 10 or 20 engineers that got together and kind of debated, and it was more fact-finding. So it would just be sort of I think this is what happened or might have been the problem. And you would be lucky if you walked out of there with anything to do, an action item. It was mostly just we think this is what happened. So one of the first things that we did is try and restructure it, both so that it happened all regularly. So we now have a weekly reliability review where we look at every incident that touched availability or durability, as well as all SEV1s and SEV0s. So we have a way to make sure that we're always talking about it. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that the meetings themselves were effective. So we moved away from doing fact-finding and into it being more about validation and oversight. And specifically what we did is make sure that the people in the room knew why they were there. And that included having senior engineers that were outside of the systems that were at issue. And they were really there to make sure that there weren't any gaps in thinking, there wasn't a particular global context that was missing around the incident. Additionally, we found it very helpful to have directors or VPs, depending on the level of the incident, be in the room. And if you think about it, it's important for them to be there, both for oversight, but also because any work that's going to come out of that is going to be by nature interrupt, right? Most people have a full roadmap of work to do, and so if you're trying to prioritize something else, it's going to come at the cost of other planned work. So having the person accountable overall for the deliverables for that team in the room to say, yep, this is important, we're going to do it and prioritize it, is going to help ensure that it's going to get done. But really, I do think that the key to our success was that the first rule of reliability reviews, and the second rule of reliability reviews, and the third rule of reliability reviews is to be blameless. Without a culture of openness and trust, people are going to be afraid to talk. You're not going to have meaningful conversation. And overall, the process is just not going to be useful. One of the other major changes we made to reliability reviews was actually a meeting format. And this is a really complicated slide, and I'm not going to talk about it. But the high-level takeaway here is that instead of going through an incident by talking about the timeline and then talking about the root cause, and then what went well and didn't go well, and then stepping through the action items if you're lucky to make it that far before the meeting runs out, we realized that we would have a much more meaningful conversation if we broke up the incident into a format we call discovery, recovery, prevention. So discovery, and really what this means is that we're talking about both the incident itself, like that part of the incident, as well as the action items taken in order to make sure that they're appropriate. And rather than dive into it in the abstract, let's talk about an example. So one of our subs was Cruel Ruff. For those of you that don't know, that's what one looks like. It's a funky looking bird. And in this particular sub, a critical feature was broken for iOS. And during the reliability review, we would look at the postmortem and see that for this particular incident, discovery took 26 days. And of that, the detection itself took 25. Looking at it more closely, you can see that it went undetected both internally and by our beta users, as well as, and it was first discovered externally and reported to our customer support. And then from there, they contacted an engineer. The engineer said, yep, this is a problem, and filed the sub. But as soon as they filed that sub, we got a diagnosis within 2.5 hours. And I'm not going to show the recovery portion of it, but I'll assert that it actually only took 4.5 hours to get there. So the power of this format is really, you can then look at straight at the action items for this area and say, okay, well, they're going to add automated tests, they're going to add manual tests, they're going to add an alert and some metrics, and they're also going to then move the last part of it so that CX can file a sub, so there's a little bit dust downtime there. And then in the room, you can say, well, what would the detection time be if all of that was in place? Would it be two days? Would it be 1 day? Would it be a couple of hours? And then as a groom, you can ask yourself if that's acceptable. Okay, that makes sense. I feel like the end result of this is going to be good, or we might need to actually change and add a few more action items because we want to aim higher. And what we've actually found is that we're in this strange new world. I want to introduce Tammy. She is a manager, SRE manager, for two of our important infrastructure teams, our database and storage teams. And this was totally unsolicited. I found this quote in a random Slack channel where people were talking about their favorite meeting, because we're nerds. And she said, I think that Sev Zero reviews with RVP, because they're high-level incidents, are her favorite meeting, because she always learns so much. And so we end up in this place where, instead of dreading coming into the room, people are actually able to come in feeling like they're learning a lot and coming out being able to be better at their jobs. Okay, so the last part of the sub process was around action items, and we, you know, I'm not gonna talk about them, everybody knows what they are, but really what we got out of this was that because we had put them into a ticketing system, we now had a way of making sure that they were actually getting done. So that was helpful. And in fact, for us, we don't actually close an incident until all of the action items are complete. Okay, so I said that we had two issues that we were trying to solve. The first was being better at incident management, and then the second one was figuring out how to scale reliability across the board, because we had inconsistencies and we wanted to talk to everybody and tell them how to be better. And so the output of that sub process gave them the data that we needed to start looking into that second piece. So our first question that we had asked ourselves at the outset was, which services were impacting our users? And what we found was, okay, now we could explicitly tell you which ones were, at least the ones that had already broken and therefore were into our incident management system or our ticketing system. And so what we decided was that, okay, so we have systems that we know are in the serving path, and we know we have systems that accidentally end up, or you know, maybe they're there but nobody realized it, being able to impact our users. And we wanted a way to be able to communicate to those service owners and talk about what the expectations were for their reliability. So we created this definition that we, for a system that we call a critical system. And basically it just means that anything that can affect the availability or durability of our users will be considered critical, and then from there you're going to have an additional reliability expectations for yourself. We had a second question, which is wanting to know why things were breaking. We got a bunch of data from all of the subs that we were looking at, but what we found when we stepped away was that, you know, to some extent, sure, individual reasons why things fail are important and we should fix them, But the biggest thing we should be doing is just expecting things to fail, right? And so first, we know things should fail because this is from some research that Google did where they found that for every 10,000 machines, you can expect all of this kind of hardware failure within the first year alone. And you know, we have our own data centers, so we have to be prepared for that. So the next thing that we did is just try and be able to deal with that. So we brought a little bit of the chaos back by introducing a version of Netflix's Chaos Monkey, where we introduce random rack failure to our data centers twice a week in order to make sure that we're resilient to it. But hardware failure isn't the only type of failure that can happen. So for critical systems, we make sure that they are always and consistently testing all of, or as many failure modes as they're able. And so that makes sure that they're able to handle things like one of your dependent systems blinking offline, or perhaps your tech lead going on vacation because people dirts are a thing. You want to make sure that everybody else on the team knows how to resolve an issue. And so for critical systems, we have an expectation that they're continuously running dirts. We also wanted to be able to talk about fixing things. And so for our critical systems, we have a fairly stringent expectation that any action items that come from a high severity incident are not overdue. You just have to finish them. If we want to be more reliable, we need to make sure we're preventing issues. And then the last thing we wanted to look at was, can we be faster? And we found that there were a couple of different things that, if we advocated for them, would have a measurable impact. The first was being able to roll back quickly. It's probably not surprising, but most failure is when, you know, something bad changes, you know, somebody pushes bad code or bad configuration. And being able to rapidly recover from that is going to drastically reduce the impact. Go figure. Also, having auto remediation in place, critical. Computers are always going to be better at this than we are. So as much as possible, you want your failure modes covered by auto remediation. And finally, you must have strong core on call, like, or on call, I should say. If you have a system that can impact your users, you need people online to be able to resolve them if something happens. And I use the word strong because it's not enough to just have one. You need the culture to be there where they take it seriously. And I actually wanted to include this example also from Slack. I swear I don't spend my time trolling for quotes, where I saw somebody who was on call and realized that they had to do an upgrade for their OS. And they asked, oh, can somebody else take my on-call for this shift? I think my favorite part about it, though, was that the person taking it knew exactly how long it was going to take. Like, I'll take your override for 50 minutes. You don't get an hour. You get 50 minutes. Okay. So we now have several measures that we wanted, and now we just needed to put it all together. We have systems that we need to talk to. What did we do? Well, we built what we call a scorecard or a report card, where every month we ask all of our critical systems to tell us how they're doing on these reliability measures that we've asked of them. And the goal, of course, is to be all green, but it's not really expected. It's not possible. Instead, what we're really asking is for us to be able to have a transparent way of understanding how well we're doing so that if we need to, we can have a conversation and maybe reprioritize something or at least be aware of where our risks are. We know these are services that can impact users. Potentially, they are needing help or we are at risk in these areas. So how are we doing? Well, let me go back to the database team. Well, they are actually in a much better place. For the last year, they've been focusing on reliability, specifically using a lot of the data that they got out of our ticketing system. And they were able to sort of double down on that work. And the result of which is they've had no high severity incidents since Q3 of last year. That's huge. I don't know how many of you are in this way, but for me, most of the times, databases are some of the most fragile in the serving path. Not only that, when they do have incidents, they've been able to reduce their MTTR by 25%, which is a great win. And finally, they've been able to double down on reliability enough that we're halfway through migrating out of an old legacy database that has been around for a while. And you know, anytime it used to go down, Dropbox would go down, and we're almost free, yay. Okay, So that was great for databases, but what about the rest of infrastructure? Well, generally, we've seen a much better increase in availability overall, which is an awesome win for our users. We also have better visibility overall into the systems that matter, and now we have better accountability for them as well. But we've had limited exposure to the rest of the company. Most of our conversations and work have been with a very specific set of systems. So where are we going next? Well, we're expanding. We really want to make sure that we're building on that culture of collaboration that was so much of the success from our early days, and that we continue to improve by adding additional transparency and rigor that's worked so well for us over the last year, and add additional frameworks and standards to meet new needs of new teams. Okay, so finally, how can you potentially get started? Well, first I'd just say, get going. Just get started doing something. And I would definitely discourage you from trying to take all of what we did over the last year and implement it at once in your system. It won't work. It's better to keep it light and just get started. I'd encourage you to start by thinking about like what part of reliability is the most critical for your users. That may not be durability. It may be performance that sets you aside from your competitor. So in that case, ask yourself, what happens when your performance degrades? Are you guys really good at responding to the incident? You kind of rally and are able to push that forward? Then don't worry about improving incident response right now. Maybe your problem is making sure that you're actually fixing things. So start by maybe having a weekly meeting where you look through your open action items that haven't gotten done and either decide to do them or close them out. Just do small improvements. And don't worry about perfection. We iterated, we'll continue to iterate, you're always growing. Just get started, because what you're really trying to do is learn. The goal here is to continuously improve both individual systems as well as your entire team. And finally, I would say that you should orient yourself around why reliability matters to your company. For us, remember, it's a way for us to be worthy of trust. And I personally believe that a company's success is founded on user happiness, and that begins with trust. Thank you.